Blog Talk Radio.
Think that this is an opportunity to make things more of a quality for one's life and one's perspective going forward after the month is over. But and in all of this, when I look at, for example, my interaction here in Critical Discourse, two things that I want to make sure that I am on board with, that I am living up to. Am I clear in my discourse, in my questions, in my responses? And am I fair? Do I give due consideration to a view which may be contrary to mine, even a very strongly held view? So I'd say this provides an opportunity for me to and of course, extends other aspects of life, whether at work, a business. Am I clear in my presentation? Am I clear in what I'm producing? Am I clear in what I'm selling? And am I giving due consideration to those with whom I'm interacting? The key point, though, of the, I guess, disagreement last week, I guess how we would process and look at history or the past in terms of current events. tend to be an opinion, which I've heard in times past, that in talking right now about the reception of this president, the existing president, Barack Obama, when it comes to criticism, or as some feel, overtly overboard. Plus, you hear this term that he's been opposed every term, and there's somehow there's some top of the ill intent. Because he's black. Let's be clear. The complaints that you would get from, you heard this from Jimmy Carter, you know, the GOP opposes Obama because of the color of his skin. You've heard it from, I'm sure, your friends, your associates, that had this been Bush, had this been Clinton, he would not have undergone the intensity of his opposition. Of course, they would probably point out to the rude manner in which a member of the House of Representatives at Obama's State of the Union, one of the State of the Union addresses, blurted out, you lie. And obviously, that was out of order, and it should not be accepted or tolerated by anybody, any party. Because at the end of the day, you have to accept the office, and you just have to be courteous in a public forum. So when you're speaking publicly, you have your, well, not at the Devine address, but you have your time, you have your chance to rebut or to challenge what the speaker, in this case the president, is saying. But what I think needs to be considered, I maintain my position that you have to look at history. And again, not necessarily to be stuck on it, if it so happens that the examples that you would provide in terms of history are bad examples, one should not stand on them as a foundation for the future. In terms of opposition to policies by an opposing party, this is nothing new. It's something that I think that the Obama supporters and the emotionality have not willing to accept. And I think they're not willing to accept that they would examine some of the policies, some of the views. They are worthy of opposition. They are deserving of opposition and challenge, and hopefully being stopped by a Congress, which at the present, the majority of GOP in the House of Representatives, but the majority of senators in the Senate. You know, it is important to understand the challenges that Abraham Lincoln had, that FDR had, JFK had. And at least in the case of JFK and FDR, they had the majority Democratic Congress. Still, there was strong opposition to some of the policies, some of the proposals, and some of it you have to accept. And this president, no different. And something came up about the mention of scripture in terms of this president. You know, and I'll say and I say again, if you are a Muslim, you have a worldview which is monitored, guided by the Holy Quran. If you are a Christian, your worldview is monitored, guided by the Bible, the Old Testament and New Testament. You are a Jew. Outside of Jews and Jesus, your world perspective is monitored, guided, based on the Torah, the Old Testament, or at least the five books. I don't know how to receive other books of the Bible, but we do know that you know, they speak to Torah. So it would stand to reason that as you have on the checkoff list, when a certain position proposed, what does it stand with, stand against what I believe, what I perceive? And you make a decision, weighing the pros and cons. But most definitely, this is clear indication that one does this, or I think should do this. I mean, we take a position from our own personal vantage points. So it should be no surprise if a Muslim were to weigh things, even this president, on what we know to be our holy book and the life example of the Prophet Muhammad, prayer and peace be upon him, and all the prophets of our Lord. Well, today's show, definitely a swipe and a rebuttal to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. For some reason, can't seem to get off of this scathing attacks on Justice Thomas and Scalia. He was interviewed a few years ago during the Bush administration, claiming that he would not have voted to confirm Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia. And suppose that even as a senator, he has to write his opinion, but I've not noticed in recent memory personal attacks and vitriolic attacks on a Supreme Court justice. But I guess in terms of the Hobby Lobby decision and some of the, Voting Rights Act decisions, which Clarence Thomas, presumably voted in the majority, there's this tendency, there's this drive of white liberals to bash him. And to say that somehow you have five white men, whatever it is, on the court, rather than white, that's absurd. Clarence Thomas is a black man. He has a uniform. I'm sure you heard the saying, he's born black, lived black, and going to die black. One might have issue with some of his philosophy, which is, again, the right of anybody from their vantage points. But black people, in my mind, should have been outraged. Not just black conservatives, upon the that statement that he's not black. Is Harry Reid black? Can he define as black? I've heard the complaints that we should not allow white people to define our leaders, to define our standards. Well, this and that's what he's doing. Of course, we'll then retort. Well, I agree with Harry Reid. Clarence Thomas has shown to be Uncle Tom, a sellout. He benefited from affirmative action, but then when he gets in high office, he just, slams the door to prevent other black people from advancing. And we went into these issues and topics, the whole issue, we did shows on Clarence Thomas. And I say, pretty much so I made the case, to rebut, practically all of that, those charges. And if the charges are false, as I have observed they are, then this is tantamount to slander. Slander. That's what it is. I don't know ultimately what goes in his mind, but I would say that he is a black man who deserves a better consideration. I just really have to agree with him. You may disagree with him, his decisions. And there's nothing wrong with that. But he's been confirmed in 1991. This is 22 years, 23 years. And still, these vitriolic attacks on what I see as a decent man, a fine man, and a thoughtful man. No matter has a history, lived in the antebellum South. Harry Reid did not live in the antebellum South. Harry Reid is a member of a religious group, as is Mitt Romney, which at one time did not allow black people to join, which at one time taught a doctrine that black people have no souls. But they've made adjustments that you have black Mormons. I remember that. Because you have a woman named Mia Love. I think the mayor of Sarasota Springs, Utah, who's a Republican, and she's Haitian-American. viciously attack, again, the personal attacks, because she's conservative. But again, let us be clear here. This is part of an overall trend, by the left to engage in vicious personal attacks, vicious caricatures on, political cartoons, illustrations, vicious. That if this was, say, John Boehner talking about Obama, would have hit the end of it. And again, just to backtrack to one of the shows, this more so applies to Clarence Thomas. Colorism is a factor. Colorism as practiced by black people, black Americans, is a factor. The mere fact that black people did not come raise up in arms when it was revealed that the actor, Sam L. Jackson, in his portrayal of the Uncle Tom in Django Unchained, actually called for making his makeup so that he would look darker. We didn't raise up in protest. Made me darker. Because the message that was trying to be portrayed, that this is Clarence Thomas. If you talk to our people, that's what you heard of. The manipulation, the social engineering was right there. And true to form, you process exactly what they intended. Well, let's just say they made him light-skinned. They had a light-skinned actor playing the role. I would say it's safe to say you would hear a plethora. They're trying to pass this version of our president. He can't get a good grade. He can't get a grade. They're trying to make him look bad. You know, I believe he would do that. So I have two folks I see are waiting patiently. It's Yankee there, and I see looks like my brother Fati. So I'm going to wrap up this section of the show. My little monologue here. But we're going to talk about a few things this morning. One, you know, being the these comments by Harry Reid. Then I want to talk about one of the liberal pundits on MSNBC, the Reverend Michael Eric Dyson, who, interestingly, in this discussion of illegal immigration, in particular, the children who are being force-fed into the United States for political purposes, okay, all the part of Obama's so-called comprehensive immigration reform. Can't you see this? Can't you see what's happening? You bring in children, then you put the opposition against the wall. How can you turn back children? So he wants almost $4 billion for illegal immigrants. It's another cog of his so-called comprehensive immigration reform. No one's talking about the fact that many of these children are sent there by their parents. They're sent there. I mean, this is frankly a neglect in many of these cases. You're going to send your child because you understand that the rhetoric from this president supports and lends itself to what we see going on today, as Governor McCrary has inferred, Governor of Texas, which is another point of discussion this morning. Rick Perry met with Obama this week, Wednesday, Thursday. And what I liked, appreciated, I would say, in their meeting, Rick Perry stood up. He was not in awe, awestruck, looked him in the eye. Obviously, you know, it was the authority. The president is fully over the governor. But I liked that, you know. He wasn't fawning over Obama, okay? And he made some valid point, which is a point I've held for quite a while, that Obama ultimately wants to grant citizenship to 11 to 12 million immigrants. And the policies from his labor secretary in terms of hiring legal immigrants to his executive order, which was allowing a settlement to stay in his country, right? He's done everything. They're really proved by point. He's not looking for reform. Nancy Pelosi said that the American people should be afraid of the Supreme Court for those Hobby Lobby decisions. Now, what I'm hoping to bring up this morning in response to this Pelosi, this is Pelosi. At one time, she said she did not comment on Supreme Court cases. And this was in response to the Kelo versus New London decision in Connecticut, whereby the court said that the government can actually impose eminent domain on behalf of a private concern. If they can show that it will benefit, you know, the overall, you know, town or city, you know, money coming in, tax dollars. So at any point, a developer can make a petition to the mayor or the governor and say, I want that area here. I want to build some strip mall. I want to build some high-rise housing for upper-income people. And me and my house have to go. I'm sure it'll be some compensation, but in the meantime, I got to find a place to live. I'll have to find a place to move my family. So, interestingly enough, it was the what you call the liberal wing of the Supreme Court that voted in favor of this this Kelo, right? Now, Nancy Pelosi was relatively contrite, relatively quiet. In fact, she said the court has decided, the court has spoken. But yet she has plenty of mouth, plenty of verbiage, verbal mileage. But when it comes to the Hobby Lobby decision. And lastly, John Boehner's lawsuit has been filed. We finally found out what the issue is. Obamacare. Apparently, I guess the private mandate, the personal mandate. I'll have to check that. I have articles here. Position is that Obama should have gone to Congress rather than through executive order. And they have a case there. And by the way, for those who would criticize the GOP for not but the continual opposition to Obamacare in light of the Supreme Court decision, the Democrats are trying to do the same thing in light of Hobby Lobby. They're trying to somehow draft legislation to bypass Supreme Court decision. But again, let's understand something. You know, Supreme Court decisions are very strange because as the former judge, Robert Bork, noted, you have to, I guess, make a determination whether or not Supreme Court decisions are legislative or judicial. And theoretically, that decision applied to Hobby Lobby, the company called Hobby Lobby. But it's always a perception that when the Supreme Court decides a case, it has a far-reaching impact, just as we saw with the death penalty decision and Roe v. Wade. Yet, at some point, as we've seen with the death penalty, at some point they started to weave it back as far as their policies, despite a Supreme Court decision. So, it stands to reason that a Supreme Court decision is not necessarily etched in stone for perpetuity. Look at the Dred Scott case. Even though our attorney at war, Alton Maddox, would argue that that decision, the Dred Scott decision, is binding today. And he will argue that today, that a black man has the rights a white man's bound to respect. So he makes that point. That this is a case that lives on. Some would say, based on the actions and policies in this country, that there's some truth to that. When you look at the high unemployment rate, black people, high poverty rate, maybe there's something to that in a more intrinsic manner. So I've said enough. It's 6:57 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm going to bring on Bianchi. What's going on, Bianchi?
I was going to ask you that. That music, man, my goodness, it scared me off. I thought I had walked into some cult proceedings or something.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, for the month of Ramadan, I'm kind of like scaling down like with the music selections. Once the month's over, I'll get back to front line, what have you. But I'm doing stuff more, I guess, on instrumental only. At this point, but next week, 2 weeks from now, we'll call back to some of the regular format. And I have William on the line. Now we can ask William in a short while. In fact, let me go have him on now. I'll have him on the queue right now. He may be traveling. And I want to make sure that he gets.
I'm traveling. So I'm just listening right now.
Okay. Good. Assalamu alaikum. Blessed Ramadan. Okay, so Piyaki, I've spoken to a number of issues, the John Boehner lawsuit, Harry Lee's slander of Clarence Thomas, the illegal immigration situation with these children in, the children from south of the border coming to Texas, and the ensuing meeting between President Obama and President Barack Obama and Governor Rick Perry of Texas. So what?
Well, Clarence Thomas is a good justice, I think. And you guys, there's some background noise coming in there, man. I can hear myself say the thing twice. Better start getting that stuff together. We're going to get Clarence Thomas on you.
Yankee, you might have your speaker facing your microphone.
I don't have no. I got my speaker on my lips and my speaker on my ear and my microphone on my lips.
Well, it might be Quasi might have his speaker on. Because I'm getting feedback too, so it might be coming from Quasi.
But, Quasi, you getting your stuff together? Oh, my goodness. I guess he is.
Yeah, it sounds like he's listening to the, okay, there it is. Yeah,
you get things ready, Squadzy? Yeah, anyway, as I was saying, I think Justice Thomas has proven to be a good jurist. He's constantly defending defendants in trials. He said that, especially on minimum sentences, he said that that should be left up to a jury and not a judge. You know, there was a case where a person who, in a case, I think the case, I can't even remember the name, Alan Laney.
I'm back. Any better?
Yeah, as I was saying before, I think that Justice Thomas is a darn good justice myself. And I don't know why come you got some of these liberal groups that's against him. Heck, blacks where minimum sentences has been used against them, so they claim more than anything. Thomas says just no more than in which it is. It's guaranteed them a right to a trial by jury. And he said in Minton, in the, as related to minimum sentences, as in the case between the United States and Lindy, that whether or not a minimum sentence is handed down should not be up to the judge, it should be up to the jury. He said that in when you're walking through the airport and they want to use those that technology where it can give an image of your body, he said that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So that and many other cases shows that he's been and there's cases where I didn't like some of the rulings that he gave. One of the most recent cases that he ruled on, and I thought that that case was wrong. And it'll come to me here in a minute.
I think you mentioned that a few weeks ago about the prayer. It's prayerish, I believe.
Right. I didn't like that. That a city council can start off with a prayer before, you know, they begin their meeting. I was totally against that.
Yeah, but they have done that in times past. And I guess someone challenged it. I suppose it was challenged, you know, by, and again, it's an interesting issue because I give an example. You know, when I was in elementary school, I don't know if they still do this, but we had the principal, you know, from the office through the loudspeaker. We'd all do the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay? Now, those who are members of the Jehovah's Witnesses take a position, make no pledge of any type of flag, man, you know, any man-made government. So there were two children in my class, one boy and one girl. They were allowed to walk out to the classroom, stand outside in the hall.
That was good.
So the pledge is over. So I'm saying, though, if one has such an issue with being said, you know, before the Houses of Congress or the state legislature, I think one has the option to leave the room.
What would happen if the whole room stepped outside the hallway?
Well, let them step out. Step out. You know, I mean, yeah.
And whose prayer are you going to start off a meeting with?
Well, again, that goes to a whole nother arena, okay? And I was about to, you know,
well,
make
no,
that
it's
point.
Not a whole nother. It's part of the topic because, like I say, whose prayer would you start off being that this country is so diverse?
Well,
whose prayer would you start off with?
Well, I would say you would
not
prayer.
Prayer because how about atheists? Atheists should be respected also, shouldn't they?
And they can
they're
walk
United
out the
States citizens.
They can walk out the room.
Yeah, but you can't get up when you're in a when you're in a public, like for instance a council meeting that's you sometimes it may be packed. I mean, come on, where are you gonna make those provisions at?
Well, you know, again, this isn't the topic at hand, but you know, that's my answer. That's what I can tell you. That's
my
answer.
All right.
You know.
Well, I was against Thomas on that particular one.
Okay, and that's okay. Again, it's never been an issue with me that, and I've always made this point, that Clarence Thomas cannot be disagreed with, cannot be challenged. But my main issue are inaccuracies and vitriol. Because, again, I want to go back to Obama said after the shooting of Gabby Giffords. The point he was making, because the perception was because of the right-wing rhetoric. Okay, I guess some websites had a picture of a photo of Gabby Giffords with like a target around it. So the theory is that the vicious, sadistic killer and shooter, Gerald Lagner, visited these websites, and he became so influenced and so distorted that these vitriol influenced him to go shoot Gabby Giffords and others. Some were killed in this in the shopping area in Arizona. So he gives a speech on discourse, you know, civil discourse, which is fine. But somehow I get the sense this only means civil discourse, you know, when it comes to liberals. But you can you have the Senate Majority Leader. What did he say here? He said that I'm going to read part of this article here. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's description of Justice Clarence Thomas as one of the five white men triggered a backlash Wednesday on social media for black conservatives. Okay, Mr. Reid's gaffe prompted a rash of posts with photos and the hashtag @ am I black enough on Twitter and other sites, including the website of former Republican Representative Alan West of Florida. Harry, are you so blind in your own political prejudice that you overlook the fact that one out of these five white men isn't, said Mr. West? And again, you know, what I find very fascinating about this was the same man that, in a book that he wrote, I refer to Obama in glowing terms as
Well, that ain't really what they're saying. What it's saying is that you got Harry Reid, who only way that he would approve of a black man sitting on the bench is that he thinks and acts white in his in handing down his judicial decisions.
Well, I think what he's saying, though, I mean, he
put the evidence out there when he talked about Obama.
Right.
He talked about, he made reference to Obama's speech being close to white, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't say this wasn't an idealistic that was going on in his mind when he said he's the right color. I mean, what color is it? Is he the color of the image of, what's the guy's name, Steven in Django? Or is he closer to his color?
Not at all. To the contrary. In fact, you know, I spoke about this in my monologue. And, you know, again, understanding that black people still have an issue with color. And this is explored quite thoroughly on the shows. That
no, it's not black people having an issue with color. It's white folks that have the issue with color. Let's get this right. What was the idea of the paper bag test then? Black folks didn't come up with no our paper bag test.
But over time, Bianchi, we began to internalize this. And we developed a sense of classness within ourselves, with our own people. I mean, let's look at the black Greeks. The black Greeks. As a rule, if you are a light-skinned female, you place AKA. If you're soft, you place Delta. Of course, it was.
Well, that's preference. That would be personal preference, wouldn't it? My personal preference for a woman is a dark complexion, petite woman.
I understand that. But I think you're missing the point here now. I'm saying that when you look at, and again, this is someone lends to your position, because I've made the observation and I express this with only love. When I look at the vast majority of homeless black people, homeless black men, I say 99% are dark-skinned.
And when you look at the ones that get the hardest sentences when they come up against the system, dark complexion, black males and females get the harshest sentence. So to say that black folks use it the way they do it is entirely wrong. That's okay. We can go on to the next point.
I'm also reminded Malcolm, in his autobiography, made the point in his own family, with his own family. He spoke on how his father, even with him being a Garveyite and being a proud black man, he observed that his father, when it came to meeting out discipline, a lot harsher on his brothers than he was on him. His perspective is that, despite his father's outward sense of pride, there's still that germ in his brain that somehow the lighter was to be treated a little more differentially than the darker. His own family. We hear about cases in Hispanic families where you have dark relatives who are sometimes, you know, pushed to the back. So of course, we can recognize the source of this. Of course, the source of this is a white supremacist mentality, white supremacist policy. But it doesn't at all detract from my point that how we process this within our own people.
Yeah, I think that it's more on a political level than it is anything else. That's the case when the baby came out the mother's womb. If it was too dark, she would have threw it away like rabbits do.
Well, I don't have any record of that, so I can't comment on that. But again, I don't see that as being really tantamount to the discussion here. But again, I respect your view.
Let's ask William. William is a strong fan of Clarence Thomas.
Oh, you're trying to start something, aren't you? You're trying to start something up today. Oh man, what's that Jackson song? You want to be starting something?
William and Austin had both.
Yeah, it sounds like
phone went again. Yeah. Yeah. Got a lot of Harry Reid in it.
Hey.
6652. Last four numbers. 6652.
Assalamualaikum.
Assalam. How are you?
I'm doing good. Alhamdulillah. Ramadan.
Good. Sister Salima, how are you? Blessed Ramadan to you, sister.
Blessed Ramadan to you. Alhamdulillah.
Yes, yes. Good. I just want to remind for those in the audience that Sister Salima is one of the hosts on the Monday evening show called Adam, Voice of the People. This is Monday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. on your same station, www.blogtalkradio.com/the new day for Al Islam. Same call-in number, 213-816-0356. So, Sister Salima,
yep,
on what we discussed so far. We brought up, I gotta get you your email address. I can send you the agenda in advance.
That would be good. Then that way someone prepared to be able to
call you, or I can give it to Brother Blue Queen. I would get it from him rather, but I need to get you. But we'll talk off the air. So we're talking about a number of issues. The title of the show. Harry Reid referring to Clarence Thomas as white. The lawsuit, the John Boehner lawsuit, the continuing saga of the use of children to further an agenda of illegal immigration under the guise of comprehensive immigration reform. By the way, you know, I happen to be looking at Fox News, and the interviewer got a hold of a black woman. I guess probably in her 30s, mid to late 30s. And she was quite upset. She said, here is Obama wanting to allocate $3.7 billion for illegal immigrant children, yet nothing for our people here, nothing for her children. And I bring this up because on both sides of the aisle, we tend to make this point that you spend the money on this, spend the money on that, but you spend it on so-and-so. You know, all the money spent in the war in Iraq, if it goes to Iraq, nothing spent here. Again, I'm saying that our natural sensitivity and affinity to the children is being really manipulated by this administration. I don't think it's an accident that suddenly now we have an influx of children with a few adults coming to the border. And I'm saying they want to force an idea, force a view that, well, GOP hates children. They even let children starve. I think this is a big setup all the way. And now you want $3.7 million? A billion dollars, I think. Yeah, $3.7 billion, I think he's asking for. So those are some of the topics. And hopefully we can talk about Michael Eric Tyson, who indirectly used the Bible in his argument in this regard. So those are, and I have William here. I mean, William, he's listening, so he's always welcome, as all you are here, to interrupt, chime in. Say what you think. So we're here at 7:17 Eastern Standard Time. So any comments, Sister Salima, on some of these issues? Anything you have to say about some of these newsworthy issues?
Well, I'm not really feeling great about this immigration thing because of, like, what the black woman was saying. We have children here that have needs, and their needs haven't been met. You know, we have a lot going on with African American children. A lot. And it seems to me that they spend the money all over the place you know, into different, you know, little wars and this immigration, and they're not really putting a lot into addressing the African American, the black children issues. You know, we have a lot of our young people shooting. We got a lot of them dropping out of school. We got a lot of them being brainwashed by all this type of music. A lot of our children spend their monies in things like clothing and shoes. Well, shoes and clothing, I can put those both in the same category. And they really don't have, they don't spend their money long term. They spend their money short term. They spend it on, I want this right now, but really not knowing how to plan and, you know, spend their money in a way where it will be beneficial for them and their children you know, for the next generations. Our children aren't learning all these types of things. So it's many places where we can put our money, and money can be spent for black children, and it's not being done on a big scale. Yeah, they throw us a few dollars to shut us up, you know, by opening up different types of programs. But even when programs are open up for our children, a lot of them don't even take advantage of these programs, such as, for example, scholarships. They got a lot of scholarships out there for black children. But how are they going to take advantage of those scholarships when they can't even get through high school? You know, and then the ones that are getting through high school, they don't really have a lot of, they don't have parents. Well, I'm speaking of the majority, because we do have many educated black families. But I'm going by, you know, the majority. When they do finish high school, they don't have the guidance of someone to show them how to get through college. You know, they know, oh, well, I do have to apply for the financial aid, and I do have to do this, but they don't really have no one who they can look at as an example who've been through this, you know, in their, you know, far as their parents. So, yeah, we do need to take that money that they want to use for immigration and put it into the black families. They put money all over, you know, different groups of people, but for some reason they have a hard time with really investing in black children. So I do have a problem with immigration, little problem.
Well, how about this now? Let's think about this now. You know, when you talk to people, black people, who traveled overseas, traveled to Africa, traveled to South America, Brazil, India, they will tell you, we here in this country have no idea what poverty really is. When you go to India, my son was in India, children were clinging on his leg, begging for some money for food. That's poverty. And they will therefore make, I guess, the case that the children in Mexico are experiencing poverty. In fact, they're dealing with drug wars, okay, and killings and shootings. So these children are really not to be compared, and their plight is much more serious than the plight of, because as you said earlier, that in many cases we do have certain services at our disposal that we don't take advantage of. Now, you know, in this discussion of illegal immigration, we've had the discussion a few times on this show. There's a perception. In fact, one of our callers, you know, said he welcomes the immigrants. He welcomes them because he sees them as really, my words, a worthwhile investment. So what I'm saying, that there's a perception that these children who come across the border, right, have a different ethos, a different mindset, a different set of values, that the money invested in them will go further because they're going to work. They're going to develop, create communities, build families, not going to glorify, not going to glorify as a badge of honor, unwed motherhood. Okay, so could that not be an argument that, yeah, okay, fine, but they have shown to be a worthwhile investment along this line. And as you said earlier, that our children here, we spend the money on sneakers and foolishness. So why should I urinate the money away when I have a sense that money spent elsewhere will yield a greater dividend?
Oh, okay. First, I want to say that I did travel overseas, okay? I stayed in Pakistan for some time, so I have seen firsthand of the poverty that happens with, you know, the children being in poverty and the families being in poverty. I even went through, I visited a mud hut, I mean literally a mud hut village, which was, which was interesting. It was just, you know, I've never seen it actually firsthand. I only seen this type of stuff on television until, you know, I actually visit. But I believe our children want as much as those children who's working hard in those countries. Our children want it too. I don't know why people believe that our children don't want it because of the way, you know, is happening, what's happening with them today. Our children want it, but they don't know how to do it. So how are they going to know how to do it when their parents don't know how to do it, and their parents don't know how to do it, you know?
Yeah.
So, and because we got this little welfare system that's going on, and then our children get this their little job, and they spend their money on sneakers or the latest fashion or getting their nails done, rather than investing their money in the long term. A lot of them may not know how to do this, is what I'm saying. They've been so conditioned to, oh, they got to impress their peers. They've been conditioned. So they'll get their money again. They'll get their money, and they won't learn how to use that money for in an investment, is what I'm saying. So, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead. You finish.
I say, I feel sorry for third world children, because when I was there, children were begging, coming up to me begging. And I wish I had enough to give all of those children, but I didn't. I couldn't even really pull anything out, because for some reason, if you pull something out for one, next thing you know, you're going to be mobbed, because it's they're all going to come out from the woodworks. Children, I seen children with bowls of berries trying to sell just so they can get some money so their family can get a bag of rice. Yeah, I know how it is over there in those countries. It's very, very, very sad. I visit a community when I was over there, because I was on the borderline where the part of Pakistan that I was in was on a borderline of Afghanistan. So it was a lot of them crossing the border because they were trying to escape the war. You know, the conditions, rather, the conditions that the war had brought to their country. And so they were living in tents, whole families, literally living in tents, you know. And so I couldn't speak the language, so I had an interpreter. And they were telling me that they walked on foot, you know. They put some of them had donkeys where they load the donkey up, and or some just had their belongings just they can carry in their hands. And they said they hope that their husbands would be able to find jobs in Pakistan, which was already a poor area that they were in. You know, so they was hoping to be able to, you know, make it in a country that already, you know, needed help. And but the beauty thing about that is that in their culture, that the people that already was living there, their neighbors that was living close, if they knock on their neighbor's door, they have to give. They have to give them food. They have to share their food. That's just what their culture do. So if they come with a bowl, because I lived in a house where the poor people would come, they would have their little bowl, and they would just come to the house. The cook of the house don't ask no questions. All she do is take the big spoon, dip whatever that was in that pot, in that bowl, and that homeless or that hungry person would just walk out. No conversation is done, nothing. They just, the only conversation is done is salam alaikum. And they dip the food and then they leave. But see, that's what that culture do. They have to share. I guess when the Quran says you can't go to sleep unless, I mean, you're not a believer. If you go to bed full in your neighbor's belly and your neighbor is hungry.
You don't want
so
your brother
they really
you
honor
yourself.
That. Real heavy. Excuse me?
Well, you know, I say something. Something you just did for me. In making this case, you know what you are saying in essence, in particular with the at the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, talking about the war. I'm assuming the invasion of Afghanistan by Bush in 2001. You know. If I were to look at different levels of, I guess, suffering of children, okay, at this point, I'm going to say black American children. Now, perhaps Mexican children. But even more so, more critically, these Afghani children. The difference that these Afghani children are refugees dealing with an extreme situation. When you have...
That's called by America.
Okay, well, I'll get there. You have refugees who, due to an extreme situation, have to uproot and get out. The Mexican children that are coming to the United States of America with these buses are walking are not refugees. Yes, I don't doubt there are problems in Mexico. I don't doubt that. But they are being used as psychological weapons. And I'm saying by the Obama administration to try to force the case. Because if you recall, just 2 weeks ago, they were saying that the immigration so-called reform issue was dead. We weren't going to vote on it. Next thing you know, we have these children being thrust in or walking through the borders. Obviously, as adults, we have a sensitivity towards children, particularly if you have children of your own. You have that, you know, That natural inclination to want to see children being taken care of and protecting the children. I'm saying this is a part of a manipulation process to force the GOP to quote-unquote vote or, you know, I mean, $4 billion is a lot of money. A lot of money, you know, for those who are not citizens. And again, they're not refugees. The Afghani children are refugees. These children, as I have seen here, I've heard, I consider refugees. These are boat children trying to come in from Cuba. We know that the Haitians were turned, they turned back. Haitians are not allowed to go come in through boats. The Cubans what? Because the perception, just going back a bit, that the perception was that the Cubans were, I guess, refugees in totality. I forget the term that was used. Political refugees. Whereas the Haitians were considered to be economic refugees, just therefore a better financial position, but not because of an oppressive government. Even though we knew, those of us, particularly if you live in New York and knew Haitians, you knew about the despots, Papa Doc and Baby Doc, Jean-Claude Duvalier, okay? It's 7:33 Eastern Standard Time. Those who are listening in or watching on a computer, call in, 213-816-0356. We're here on www.blogradio.com/EverydayForAlislam. That's just a quick announcement here. It's kind of retro. It's kind of past. I'm sure those of us who are from New York had learned of the passing of Amina Rasool. She was the captain of the MGT of Mosque Number 7. I don't know if she served under Malcolm, but she served under Mr. Farrakhan. Amina Rasool returned to Allah. Her janaza was Thursday. Speaking of that nation out, you know. Yes.
That is an honor, actually, to be going during the month of Ramadan, the most merciful month of that Allah sits down, and the gates of hell is closed. May Allah forgive her all her sins and grant her the highest station of paradise. But
Did you know her?
Do I know her?
Did you know Captain Rasool? Did you know her?
No, I didn't. Mm-mm.
I saw her once she spoke at an event at the masjid. Well respected.
Well respected, you know. Listen.
Well regarded, highly regarded. Yes, I mean. So, William, are you there? Are you traveling to fall asleep? I don't like William to be so quiet. So contrite. I hope he's okay.
You know, my suggestion, and I've given it on other shows on those children, is that they need to give them some water on a busload of them, give them water and a Happy Meal, and send them back where they came from.
The
price of the water and Happy Meal that's expended should be deducted from any foreign aid that's given to the country that they come from.
You know, I tell you, what's interesting about this is, what I have observed, at least the past two presidents of Mexico, sign on to this policy. I'm still in disbelief when I think about, I'm assuming so the president, Calderon, came here on a state visit, which coincidentally was, I guess, around the time of the passage of SB 1070, Arizona SB 1070, its illegal immigration policy. He actually spoke before a joint session in Congress to defend his countrymen and women coming here illegally. And let me remind people, Mexico's own constitution speaks to illegal immigration. And if you're either an illegal immigrant or you assist in one in that process, you go to jail. And I remember watching Fox News, which I don't watch too much at all. This is some years ago. Bill O'Reilly was interviewing the former president, Vicente Fox. And he was trying in vain to get Vicente Fox to acknowledge this is a problem. You know, how can you just sign on to your country that's coming across the border illegally? And he tried to hem and haw and evade and answer the question. He wouldn't answer the question. You know, this is incredible to me. You know, but I would tend to agree with what Piyaki's saying. You know, give him some type of, give him a Happy Meal, you know. Maybe give him some, greens also, You go back. You go back to the border. Go back to the outside of the border. You have no business. And I want to make it clear here now, and I'm going to get to my next kind of subtopic here, which I think is worth noting, worth reading. This is regarding Mr. Michael Eric Dyson, the Reverend Michael Eric Dyson, Professor Michael Eric Dyson. Throughout history, there have been immigration. For those who would know that the Prophet Muhammad, when he's fleeing the disbelieving hypocrites in Mecca sent emissaries to Ethiopia. They did have to go. They were refugees. Okay? Now, to my knowledge, he did not, you know, engage in a policy that was the movement of the Muslim community, you know, the residents of Mecca, to live in Ethiopia. He did establish some kind of relationship between his emissaries and the Negus of Ethiopia, that of the, I guess, emperor of Ethiopia. But I wanted to just, you know, I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw Michael Ellis Dyson, who was a reverend, and I make this point for a reason. He has gone on record as supporting homosexual so-called marriage as a reverend. And in fact, when Barack Obama announced his long-held view, support of this, he was allowed to, because he does guest slots on, he places Ed Schultz. He places him on MSNBC. I guess Ed can't make it, was on vacation, whatever. And he was really allowed to lambast black people who had an opposition to that policy of Obama. And he used the term for those who came from a biblical standpoint, sexual rednecks, which I'm trying to understand the logic. But just saying that from a biblical standpoint, marriage is man and a woman. And I talked earlier in my monologue that...
Who was that, Jackson? Obama?
No, that was Michael Eric Dyson.
Oh, Dyson.
Dyson. So... But let me finish this point here. So he makes this whole rant calling black people who oppose this as sexual rednecks, and obviously ignoring the Bible, not mentioning the Bible. Long behold, in this this issue, situation with the children, women with children, he posts a verse from the Bible. Now, I've never seen, ever, I've not seen on what I'm going to call non-religious news, show, a posting of a religious scripture. I've never seen this. Folks say, "Well, I'm going to try to make the point about the right wing, all the religious, yet get the chance to prove you religious." And you know, of course, those who say that. But of all books, the book of Leviticus, which, frankly stating, has harsh laws of other topics. Harsh laws. So he posts on the screen, on the monitor, Leviticus 19:33-34. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So, what then happens, this is used as, I guess, a buttress against those who have an issue with these full-face changes coming in from that.
Well,
whatever. Yeah, go ahead, please.
That passage is saying when strangers sojourn, that means they passing through.
Right.
I don't mean that they stand.
Right.
Open your front door and open your back door and let people, you don't mind if people come through the front and walk straight on out the back all day long. But it's when
right.
they stop and sit down at the table is when that causes problems. Because it's costing you then.
I couldn't disagree more. Because the key thing over here, again, I don't know the Hebrew. I have to talk to some of my Hebrew Israelite friends who are up on the Hebrew. But looking at the translation.
No, don't talk to the Hebrew. Talk to the Egyptians. It's their land. Representing the land like myself. That's what that passage means. It don't mean that you got a right to sit down at the table and eat.
Bianchi, I'm going to argue that point. I'm just saying to you, I'm looking at the term sojourn. I have to get some clarity of what the word sojourn is. Because ultimately, the Bible, this passage was in Hebrew. So I say it's...
Well, it wasn't a religious content. It was based on the culture of the land. I'm telling you, the culture of the land means you got a right to pass through, but you don't have a right to stay.
Bianchi, I'm not arguing that point with you. Listen to me, please. Listen to me. Listen to me. I'm saying in terms of political discourse, if you will, it serves, I think it serves all of us to get a clear understanding. Because, again, if this, what I see here, when a stranger sojourns with you, that tells me you both are like, you know, they're sojourning with you. What does that mean? They're traveling with you from land A to land B or sojourning to your country, whatever. So I understand this is a misapplication. It does not mean that you just come in and stay. Of course not. All right? You know, you take care of him. You treat him with respect. Okay? You try to address his or her needs as best you can.
And then the point, where are y'all going? It don't say anything about staying in. It says, where are you going? What's your final destination?
No, I understand that.
Your final destination. And see, here's another point. Your final destination with the whole idea of you're going to return back where the hell you came from.
No, Jackie, I understand that. But again, the point being, I think you're missing the point. The point being, I'm taking to task Michael Eric Dyson, who all of a sudden wants to quote the Bible on a position that he takes.
Well, he's a hustler.
I understand that. But it is my intent on this show to bring these things to light. Because, again, he was the one. I've not seen. Not to say that it has not happened, but I've not seen any really news, show.
Dyson
or segment.
Basin. They both leverage against each other to be the mouth spokesperson for quote-unquote, so-called black community.
Well, of course. You already know this. And, I mean, I recognize that Dyson is full of it. For years, he's been full of it. You know? But, again, it just is kind of like really comes out and hits you. Because this is clear. You know, again, but I want to just read a perspective on this, okay? The website where I got this from. This is his commentary response. False teachers such as Jim the Gospel, it's all about wealth and distribution. Wallace insists that we should apply that teaching to the U.S., but do they preach that we should follow the next chapter as well, not to mention the rest of Leviticus, of the Old Testament? Of course not, which is a point I made. You know, that book of Leviticus, book of laws, and it's harsh. It's harsh, to tell you. Some stuff that some of us do, some of us. Woo, boy. You're part of Leviticus? Problem. Okay? But again, I understand that. Bianchi, that this is very disingenuous and dishonest.
Yeah, but your listeners may not understand it.
Well, they're understanding that hopefully, because when they go back and listen to this, you know.
The likelihood, it's best for them to get it when it's fresh than to come back when it's stale.
I understand that. But to be truthful, I get more people listening on the archive than live. You have to realize this is an early show. A lot of people are still sleeping. You know, and I would say that probably some of my Muslim brothers and sisters have waking up early in the morning for their Sahur meal and making the Fajr prayer have probably, you know, especially on Saturday, have taken advantage of a little extra time and are probably sleeping. So, 7:47. Time is a moving. So, what's your sense of this lawsuit by John Boehner against Obama in regards to his?
I can't comment on that myself. Maybe somebody else can because I haven't gave that too much consideration.
Yeah, I'm trying to sift it. Apparently, there's something with the this. Okay, this is, I guess, the statement in the lawsuit. In 2013, the president changed the health care law without a vote of Congress, effectively creating his own law by literally waiving the employer mandate and the penalties for failing to comply with it. That's not the way our system of government was designed to work. No president should have the power to make laws on his or her own, Boehner said in a statement. Obviously, it's not the lawsuit. The lawsuit would be a much more detailed you know, dissertation of the various charges and their legal link on jargon. He added, if the president can get away with making his own law, future presidents will have the ability as well. The House has an obligation to stand up for the legislative branch and the Constitution. That is exactly what we will do. And in all fairness, the laws are voted and passed by Congress, both houses, the House and the Senate. And it's up to the president to sign or veto such proposed such bills. The president does not like what's brought before him, he has the right to the right of veto. From which then the House must vote again to try to override the veto. He can do so, I believe, only with a 2/3 majority. And if more likely, the president the vote did not go, of course, 2/3 in the first place, more likely that the president will be able to sustain the veto, and they will not get another re-rallying opportunity to get more votes on the side of the majority. I have another call here, 0261. 0261, the last four digits. 0261.
Yes, speak,
Wally. Oh, okay, okay. All right, I forgot you had strike. That's right. I forgot that was your other... You guys got it good, man. You have two cell phones? Oh, man. Gosh.
No, this is the house phone.
Oh, 347? Wow, interesting. 347. Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah, this is the house phone.
Wow. So you've been traveling to your home, so...
man.
So we were just talking about John Boehner's lawsuit. Kind of gotten, I guess, a better idea of what his issue is, what his point is. And apparently it's with Obama's changing the law by something, by waiving the employer mandate and the penalty for failing to comply with it. Apparently something, I guess, that was added to the law after the vote. Assuming, well, not the vote, after the, well, the vote, and after the Supreme Court decision. I'm presuming this is what happened. That is kind of thrown in there as a law. And, you know, that cannot be binding and standing as a law. It's a binding law. There's one thing about executive orders now. Executive orders can't be changed by a president. They're probably the most transient of all the laws that are passed. Because you figure, prime example, we'll look at overseas abortions. Clinton signed an executive order allowing it. Bush signed one to deny it. Obama signed one to allow it. Those are much more transient than laws that are passed by Congress and signed by the president. You know, so one would imagine that. If the next president in 2016 is Republican, they'll probably rescind that order. I'd also say, I mean, Obama's point that he has consulted with legal experts, and he feels that he's within his rights to do this. I think perhaps a better move on his part would have been to draft, a separate law, if you will, and not attach it to Obamacare. This is, I think we have to have this policy. I'm going to call it the presidential order for employer mandates. Okay? That would have been probably given a stronger leg to stand on from a legal standpoint, rather than, as I'm understanding it, amending the law. Which, yes, was voted in by Congress. Was voted in by Congress. Right? You can't add to the law. You have to encourage another set of legislation which Congress will vote on, and then you would sign if Congress passes. From that standpoint, Boehner may have a point. He may have a point, but I guess, in a sense, though, I'm a little surprised because, you know, from what we heard from the press, San Bernardino would have had a laundry list of cases where he saw that the executive branch was overstepping its authority. We heard about Obama signing executive orders. It seemed, and again, when we did the show on this, what I saw, there were nowhere near as many as executive orders in times past. If anything, presidents, FDR, Hoover, were much more free with the pen in signing executive orders. FDR, I think, signed, 300 a year? I don't have my notes here, but he signed quite a few, as president. 100 plus a year, quite a few. Even though he had 13 years, if you look at the number of executive orders that he signed, 13 years, he was, and presidents got away with that at the time, I suppose. Obviously, I had television and media, and people were much more, I guess, informed. Right? So you have MSNBC and Fox News, TV. You're not reporting. You have Fox News on the movies. Those are movie-tone news. You get your news reels there. But you didn't have, cable television. Who had televisions in the 40s? Television was considered to be a luxury. Now it's pretty much a necessity, if you will. Everybody has a TV now.
Well, Kwasi, the problem that I really see with this is I really think that John Boehner has gone about this in the wrong way. I really do. And I'm saying that because the branches are separate. The executive branch and the legislative branch are separate. And the executive branch might disagree with the legislative branch. And he has the power to, he can't tell them what to do, but if they have to work together in some kind of way, because they send legislation to his office, and he can either say yay or nay, he can sign the legislation, or he doesn't have to sign it. And the vice versa situation is also involved, where the legislative branch doesn't have the power to tell the executive branch what to do, because those rules and regulations have already been spelled out, and President Obama has been operating within his set of operation. For him to tell the for the speaker to tell the president, you're doing too much. You're doing too much. You're going too far. You're going too far. For him to tell him that is he played right into his hands by telling the man he's doing his job. That's basically what he's done. If he disagreed with what President Obama did, then what he was supposed to do, I think the better move would have been for him to him and his colleagues to create the legislation that would go against the some of the things that they didn't like the president doing. Now, that they were doing that, especially when it came to health care. They disagreed with this health care mandate, and since 2011, it's 50 times they've tried to, get legislation passed to go against the Obamacare situation. So I just basically think that the speaker is using the wrong tactic, and I think this tactic is blowing up in his face.
Well, another thing too, if he doesn't sign a bill and it goes back to the House and they vote that it becomes a law without his signature or not.
So, okay. The
bill does not have to become a law with his signature. They give him opportunity to sign it, but upon the reconsideration of the bill that's returned by the president with his objections, if two-thirds of each House agree to pass the same bill, it shall become law, no matter what Obama says.
Okay. Well,
right, but that usually doesn't happen because of the sway of the sway of the legislators that actually support the president.
The balance of power, right? The balance of power right now. There's no clear vast majority, either House or Congress. Yes, but I think here again, though. And what I'm processing in Mr. Boehner's lawsuit, he's speaking specifically about an addition to a law which should have been voted on by Congress. And it was not voted by, it was not presented to Congress to vote on. That's how I'm reading this.
Wait, say that again?
What I'm reading is that there's an addition to a law that had been voted on by Congress, an adjunct to the law, with the, the employer mandate. Okay, it says here, I'll read it again. This is a statement. In 2013, the president changed the health care law was established, without a vote of Congress. Effectively,
and he's saying that the Congress is on recess. The court said that they were not on recess.
No, this is another topic. No, these were the appointments for the National Labor Board. Talking about right now, and I don't know what month this was. 2013. I'm reading the statement. In 2013, the president changed the health care law without a vote of Congress, effectively creating his own law by literally waiving the employer mandate and the penalties for failing to comply with it. This is what he's saying. He's saying that he basically rewrote a law after it had been passed.
That's not right.
Well, and this is what
he's talking about, though, Kwasi, that was a part that had already been in the healthcare mandate, that part had already been in there, and I'm sure I remember this part that was in there about this the employers having to pay for contraceptions, et cetera, et cetera. I remember that part being in there, and you know it was also along the part that if you didn't get the healthcare, if you didn't get healthcare, then you would have to pay a penalty. That came up at that same time. And, you know, this thing went before the Supreme Court. I mean, they took it before the Supreme Court. You know, so, I mean, he doesn't have other recourses at this point. And this is why...
Well, that's not true, William. Wait a minute. A law has to be word by word per verbatim of the bill that was introduced. You cannot go back after the law. I mean, just think about it. Here's a law is passed. And you're going to go back and change the law, but historically the bill is what it said. Before a law becomes a law, it was a bill. And for it to be written as a law, based on the bill, it has to be verbatim.
Then I would say to you on that, that, you know, whenever that, you know, this healthcare thing that has come in, it is always going to be changeable. Why? It's changeable because it's a law in process. It's a system in process. So it's not going to stay the same. It's going to change over a period of time, and they're making a technical argument about it. It's you know, as far as doing the verbatim thing is concerned, you know, it's going to change. So you can't talk about, you know, like the word. That those laws continuously change because it's just a basic it's the basic foundation, and then as time goes on, you know,
the laws don't change, William. You see, what you're mixing up is laws and rules. The Congress passes a statute. A statute has a title. That title goes to the Code of Federal Regulations, to that particular agency, and that agency writes rules and regulations based on their interpretation of the law. So a president don't have a right to go back and change the law.
Yes, go ahead, Kwasi.
Now, you know, I think, William, what you're speaking to, at the time that the law was being debated, it was an issue of the individual payer mandate, individual payer. That was the issue. What Speaker Ben is talking about here is an employer mandate that apparently somehow. So the big issue was IACORP was an individual payer mandate. It seemed to be the big issue of contention, which I believe the Supreme Court did confirm was legal. But again,
the Supreme Court passed the employer mandate. What they did is they started making adjustments to it, okay? So to make it more even or more balanced or whatever, they started to make more adjustments to it.
The thing is that
it had passed.
Can't do that.
Who is the day?
President can't do that.
That's Congress' job to do that.
The law was already passed. The employer mandate had been passed. And
that's the way it has to stay, William.
But
that's right. It has to stay as is.
See that what you're saying don't even make sense. Because you're
saying
it does
make sense. Congress makes laws.
No.
President's not supposed to make laws.
They didn't make the law is already changed. The law, the employer mandate is already in there. The part about the individual mandate is already in there where you have to pay. Those things are in there. Now, you can contest those things if you want to, which is what they did. But the Supreme Court...
How can you contest it? If you contest it, you go to a... it's not for the president to contest it. It's for a citizen who's aggrieved by it to contest it. How the heck the president going to go in a law? If that's the case, then the 13th Amendment. That means we free on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and we slaves on Saturday and Sunday.
No. Again, I'm saying that the Republican Party, the GOP, disagreed with the health care mandate.
It doesn't matter if it's Republicans or Democrats, William. The law still, the rules is the rules.
Let's get on the same page. Now, we know that the health care mandate was contentious from the very beginning. But what winded up happening is Congress winded up passing it, all right? After it was passed, then the next thing you know, the GOP disagreed with some things, and they went against it. They took it to Supreme Court. The Supreme Court passed it, okay? And then after that happened, here it is. Over 50 times, the Republican Congress has had something to say about issues that deal with Obamacare, the health care mandate that was already passed and by Congress, it was passed by the Supreme Court, and they have continued. And now we get to this point where there are changes that are being made, but these changes that are being made are wordy changes that make it more conducive for the American people and for the health care law.
Wait a minute. Obama did not receive 100% of the votes. So how are you going to say it's going to be conducive for American people?
Because it passed Congress.
It's not no because. Here's Article 1, Section 7, Clause 2, Quasi. You need to get your Constitution out and read the thing so the people can understand what's being taught. It does not work that way. Article 1, Section 7, Clause 2.
Well, let me read something here. Let me read something. I think I could perhaps add some background, some support or background to this. Now, this is an article from July 2nd, 2013, New York Times. Crucial rule is delayed a year for Obama's health law. Washington, the significant setback for President Obama's signature domestic initiative, the administration on Tuesday abruptly announced a one-year delay until 2015 in his health care law's mandate that larger employers provide coverage for their workers or pay penalties. The decision postpones the effective date beyond next year's midterm elections. Employers groups welcomed the news of the concession, which followed complaints from businesses and was posted late in the day on the White House and Treasury websites while the president was flying home from Africa. Republicans' brief reaction made clear that they would not cease to repeal the repeal of Obamacare a campaign issue for the third straight election cycle. While the postponement technically does not affect our other central provisions of the law, in particular those establishing health insurance marketplaces in the states known as exchanges, where uninsured Americans can shop for policies, it threatens to throw into disarray the administration's effort to put those provisions into effect by January 1st, this year. I'm utterly astounded, said Sarah Rosenbaum, a professor of health law and policy at George Washington University and an advocate of the law. It boggles the mind. This step could significantly reduce the number of uninsured people who will gain coverage in 2014. Now, if I follow some type of train of logic, it seems to me that there was a mandate, okay, an employer mandate, okay, and the White House decided to delay it. Why? I'm not clear. But I'm reading this correctly. It seems to me that the point William has brought up has validity, that it was the mandate was in the law, woven into the law, and Obama decided to delay it, then decided to reinstate it. That's how it seems on the surface. If that's the case, then it kind of weakens Bannon's position. It weakens it. If that's the case. Okay? So, on the other hand, I need to read more into it. Because why would Speaker Bannon say something so glaringly false that, you know, President Obama rewrote the, in essence, added something to the law? So I'm looking at it as objectively as possible and not knowing all the particulars. But looking at that article, it seems to me that this had been in force. And it was an executive decision. Now, I say in all fairness, if the majority of GOP opposed the Obamacare, okay, and this point of contention, the employer mandate, would tend to support their position, all right, would tend to support it, I have to say, so I know more of the facts, I have to say, that for Obama to not to delay it.
Shouldn't you be more precise in what you said?
Well, it's hard because I don't understand the law.
No, it's not hard. You say that the majority of the GOP opposes Obamacare. Majority of the GOP is following the wishes of their constituents, who are American citizens.
So they should,
That's not necessarily so. I mean, that's not the way that it seems. It seems like the majority of them are following the will of the speaker or their little clique that they have going on and not taking care of their citizenry.
Well, That's not true either. But here I'm saying to you that if I'm reading this correctly, and I need your help here. If there is a portion of the law that GOP would have issues with, if that law has been rescinded, as I'm understanding this, GOP should be pleased that it's been rescinded. It is one of the points of the law that they had an issue with. Again, I have to look at this more carefully. But right now, my line of reasoning tells me that of the 9 planks, let's say the 10 planks, one plank was struck down. So if one plank struck down, then you should be happy because it ultimately is one less plank to contend with. But that said, if you go to the letter of the law, you can't do that on your own as president. So from, say, a personal, say, bias, I said, well, GOP, what's your problem? You know, he in essence is taking a part of the law that, you know, should favor you. But at the same time, if it is law, a president can't do that. The president cannot decide after the law is passed. If it's in there, he can't take it out.
Well, look, it says here that the employer mandate, a provision in the 2010 health care law that requires businesses with more than 50 persons to provide health coverage. The administration announced in July 2013 that the provision would be delayed until 2015 after the midterm election.
Right.
So, I mean, why is it being delayed? Because it's too harsh for employers. So they delayed it so that they could work on the law a little more and make it more fair-handed. That's not reasonable?
William, you may look at it from a conceptual standpoint, the reason this or lack thereof. The issue is, the contention here, when there is a law, right, and I'm assuming it's hard-coded, right, can a president upon himself make a decision without Congress? That, I think, is a point of contention. Can a president do that? You know, can a president say, I'm going to delay this, when it has been passed, contention, debate, dispute? But again, let me be clear here, and I'm saying to you again, that I thought that Speaker Boehner had a lot more on the table in terms of a lawsuit and the whole issue of executive orders. And it seems to me, without really becoming more immersed in this, it isn't as strong as I thought it would be. Though I can understand from a completely legal standpoint. See, legally, I think he has a point. Politically, socially, what have you, you know, he treads on dangerous water, you know, in my view. Again, I have not given it the time. So what's going on around the world? We have the issue with the, you know, illegal immigrant children coming into Texas, you know, the Obama conduits, what's going on in the Middle East, a lot going on, a lot going on. But I wanted to just kind of set it over to this other point here. Think about the Supreme Court. And I want to make this case here. Nancy Pelosi gave a speech. And again, I said in the monologue, my opening statements, I've never seen such a level of unprofessionalism in the term of elected officials as I've seen with the Democrats in Congress. Harry Reid referring to Clarence Thomas as white. Nancy Pelosi making a statement saying that the Hobby Lobby should make you afraid of the Supreme Court. Sotomayor, publicly rebuking her colleagues on decisions. This type of liberal entitlement is blowing my mind. But somehow you can, you know, go against, I think, established or acceptable decency and protocol. You know, she made this statement that people should be afraid. You know, somehow this is a warm moment because a private company decided that they did not want to have to contraception, pay for it out of their pockets, okay? But they said, why should we have to cover it out of our pocket? Okay, and I say, you know, I have a problem with that. I said, wow. Absolutely. I sign on to that. So somehow this becomes tantamount to a warm woman. Women's, you hear all this. It's foolishness. It's rhetoric. Okay?
That's the same rhetoric that Biden said, they're going to put y'all back in slavery.
Of course. And I guess I'm saying that this is allowed. This is allowed because, again, it somehow it titillates, you know, the emotions. You know? And again, you know, he would never say that about the Holocaust. You know, put your back. It would be an insult to say that. But yet, we're so caught up in Obama, he's for Obama, we just dismiss it.
Well, what about the newspaper in New York that called him the nigger in the White House? What about Sarah Palin?
What?
Yeah, but a newspaper is not an elected official,
right.
William.
That's true too. Right. That's but again, what newspaper?
All I'm saying to you is that President Obama has been called a lot of names. They've already
like
said that he's not a citizen. They have said that this man is not a citizen. They've said that he's a they yo, they said that he was a king.
Saying he's not a citizen was a point of order. It had nothing. Those were not elected officials saying that, were they?
An elected official who called him a king.
Who said that? Well, let me tell
you something. John
Boehner. Well, let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. Well, again, he's speaking.
And what about Sarah Palin?
What
about Sarah Palin saying that he should be impeached? How come you don't mention any of that? You can mention all the other.
Well, that's not calling him a name. That's the Constitution allows for him to be impeached.
It's okay,
because the Congress.
William, let me answer the question. Let me ask you a question. First of all, as Yonke noted, I was speaking about elected officials. In particular, the majority leader of the Senate and minority leader, who was then majority leader at the time of Kelso versus New London. Okay, she was then the Speaker of the House, actually the leader of the House. Okay, I'm saying to you, I'm talking specifically about those elected officials who, in my mind, act in a very crass, unprofessional manner. Okay, but Sarah Palin, as far as I know, whatever statement she made, she was no longer governor of Alaska or by presidential candidate. She made it as a private citizen. Okay. And I'd say, in terms of the opinion of impeachment, you've heard it about Bush. He should be impeached because of, war in Iraq.
What are they going to impeach Obama for? That's the point I'm making.
Because he's not carrying out the executive duties.
I have not heard any executive duties.
For you to say that, that's something that you have to prove.
Excuse me.
Who has proved that?
Sarah Palin is not an elected official.
No, the court's going to prove it.
It has been approved. Has it been proved?
He has to go to court.
So it's not proof that it's been approved that he's not doing his job.
I have 10 minutes left, and I want to make these points if I can. Okay, we can discuss this issue about, but again, I don't want to get into the whole thing about Obama, where he's born. That's in itself a discussion. Yes, it is a discussion. It is a discussion of note, okay? But making a point here, I'm leading into this issue of Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, who, upon the decision of Kelo versus the City of New London, said that the court, on one occasion she said that she's not comment on Supreme Court decisions. Okay? Then she said, some years later, when you have the Hobby Lobby decision, okay, that she goes on the horn. She goes publicly and says, you should be afraid of the Supreme Court. That's very, very disrespectful language from an elected official. There's a certain standard. She is a member of a branch of government. She is the minority leader, who was once the Speaker of the House. I'm saying that liberals today get license without fear of rebuke. Okay? And I say this is disgraceful. However you see the Obamacare, people feeling being picked on, again, we'll have the discussion about citizenship at another time. Okay? But I'm not gonna broach on that today. Maybe sometime in the future we'll talk about that. Okay, with Obama. But again, I recall no one as an elected official making the issue of Obama's citizenship, whether Obama should be impeached. Okay? The fact remains that Sarah Palin made these statements. She was not Governor Palin. So theoretically, she was held to a different standard. So one may argue, well, as a former elected official, you should understand protocol and at least act in court. I have a problem with that. If those feel that Sarah Palin should have been, held to a different standard because she had to once elected an official and understands there's a certain, I thought, protocol. But for Sotomayor and Ginsburg to make statements, maybe Scalia has also, I don't know. And Thomas has also, I don't know. But I do know that when it comes to these moral issues, that Sotomayor is going to get more of a pen and more support than, say, Scalia will get, or Thomas will get, or Roberts will get. But again, I've spoken to for quite a while liberal bias in media. I have MSNBC, CBS, C-SPAN, CNN. Decidedly pro-Obama. And somehow there's a feeling that they have license to speak as they please about those with whom they disagree. But this thing with this newspaper in New York, I like to hear about this article, okay? They called Obama a nigger. I thought, I'm shocked. And whoever said it, they should be rebuked. They should be condemned to the highest level. If this is in a newspaper in New York, or anywhere, they should be rebuked. Okay? So, if Bannon said it, they should be rebuked. Okay? But he didn't say it, though. But I'm just saying that, I do know that Harry Reid referred to Clarence Thomas as a white man, and I'm not hearing any type of outcry from black people at all, because we believe it. We believe he's an Uncle Tom, a sellout, he's a white man. So therefore, we don't see it as an affront to black people, that Harry Reid would so insult Clarence Thomas and talk that ill of him by white men. Again, the same Harry Reid, who earlier, years ago, wrote a book, okay? We describe Obama as basically a good boy because he doesn't have a Negro dialect, and he doesn't, he's light-skinned. So we're just about out of time, and I, as always, I want to thank our Lord, my Lord, for opportunity to be able to bring these sometimes contentious positions, not always popular positions, to the front. But I feel so compelled because, as I've said before, I say it now, in this present atmosphere, I see a lot of reluctance to think and analyze and assess the events of today, particularly when it comes to Obama. When scriptures mentioned regarding Obama, there's ridicule. Shocking areas. People I didn't think would do this make ridicule. So obviously there's a force, an energy, a natural mystic, how you want to classify it, in the air. Somehow the people's minds have been somewhat tied. So I just want to say, again, in closing, once again, a blessed Ramadan to you all, whether or not you're fasting or not, because whether or not you fast or not, Ramadan is a blessed month. It's a month in which the Holy Quran was revealed, a guidance to mankind, a guidance to people, that you understand right and wrong. And that should be the central theme for those who are fasting. These key and critical points, and us trying to retool ourselves, to reload ourselves, reload our commitment, reload our bodies, reload our minds to high levels. And hopefully you leave behind an old shell of yourself and come to a new birth. So, again, I'm hoping and praying for a successful Ramadan for us all. And hoping and praying that we do not be reflections of negative aspects that we see in others, and that we continue to grow in all areas as possible. For the time today is short. And lastly, when you climb the tree of knowledge, make sure you grasp it, clasp it, grip it with all meaning. To the branch of civil discourse. So again, assalamu alaikum. God's peace upon you. Until next Saturday.